Right now on Last Call, a President Biden stunner. Wait till you hear what he just said about interest rates and the Fed. Is the NVIDIA fever breaking? A record reversal could spell trouble for the bulls. Will the clock strike 12? Why lawmakers suddenly racing toward a ban on TikTok? Forget Bitcoin. Crypto meme coins are now hitting hyperdrive. Energy's winner-take-all era, what a wave of mergers might mean for your money. And the Oscars countdown is on. And there's a whole lot more at stake for Hollywood than just some golden statues. All that and more over this Friday hour. So belly up or buckle up or just sit up. Last Call is up right now. Happy Friday. Good evening here. Good afternoon out west. I'm Brian Sullivan. All that and more coming up across the hour. But first up on Last Call, rough week for United Airlines and Boeing, somehow even getting worse. Today, look at that. A United Airlines Boeing 737 rolled off the runway shortly after it landed in Houston, Texas. Looks like the landing gear broke. Thankfully, nobody was injured. And next, as we showed you yesterday, a United Boeing 777 taking off from San Francisco en route to Japan apparently lost a tire, had to be diverted to Los Angeles. The tire crushed some parked cars, but miraculously, nobody was injured. Could you imagine if that would have landed on the New Jersey Turnpike or I-95 or I-5? And on Monday, some shocking video of fire apparently spewing out of one of the engines after takeoff on another United Boeing 737 flight from Houston to Florida. United says the flight returned safely to Houston and passengers were put on a different plane. Believe it or not, that is not all that has happened just this week. It has been reported that a San Francisco-bound United flight from Honolulu reported an engine failure over the Pacific Ocean. That flight did land safely in San Francisco, and everybody was okay. Clearly, United and its passengers have been very lucky, likely thanks to the skill of United pilots and crew. But that said, all four of these events happened on Boeing jets. Now, of course, Boeing has been under major scrutiny over the past few months after a door plug blew off on that Alaska Airlines flight. Since the Alaska incident, other American airlines have been operating Boeing planes, but have not had the issues that United has had. So, with all the Boeing-related incidents, has maybe United Airlines been given a pass, or perhaps they've just had a run of bad luck that could have happened to anybody? Oh, and by the way, it should be noted, shares of Boeing's European competitor, Airbus, all that stock is doing is hitting record highs. Let's talk about this. Air travel and Boeing and United and everything else. Joining us now is former FAA and NTSB investigator and NBC News aviation analyst Jeff Guzzetti and Association of Flight Attendants CWA President Sarah Nelson. Jeff and Sarah, really appreciate you joining us. Jeff, I'm going to start with you. Do you think that either A, this is a Boeing issue, B, a United issue, C, some kind of combo, or D, just a really bad string of luck that honestly could have happened at any time to anybody?
I choose E, which you didn't mention, which is all of the above plus some. So we just don't know yet what happened in each of these United events. Given the initial circumstances, I don't think they're Boeing related at all. I think it's more of a maintenance or operational issue. So United Airlines will probably have some role to play there, but we just don't know yet. I do think it's just a coincidental spate of incidents. No one was injured. These happen every day in the airline industry, Brian. There's just a lot of attention being paid to them now, but they shouldn't happen. Don't get me wrong. But they do happen given the fact that there's tens of thousands of commercial airline flights that occur each day.
Yeah, but, you know, Sarah, I think we frame it in the way that Boeing, you know, they shut down the 737 MAX program for 2 years because of two fatal accidents. They've come back. The door plug blows out. And by the way, a big shout out. And I'm on United almost every single week. So I appreciate everything everybody in that cabin is doing to keep us safe, believe it or not. But it does seem just like a lot of stuff in a short amount of time.
It's a lot in a short amount of time. And the crew absolutely performed at their best in each one of these incidents. And we do owe them a lot of credit. But this is really a reminder also that aviation has been the safest form of transportation for quite some time now. That is because we have gone to a risk-based security model where we have been able to try to predict incidents before they happen, layer on redundancy of safety measures so that when things, if something gets missed, there's something else that can catch it and keep everyone safe. And luckily, no one was injured, no lives lost this week. Thank goodness, because of those redundancies. But that also includes the manufacturers, the airlines themselves, the government, ATC, and the safety inspectors. The FAA safety inspectors are so important. All of that system has been stretched so thin because we have had repeated extensions of the FAA reauthorization bill or even government shutdowns over the last several decades that have stretched the system so thin. And we just had another extension passed again this week instead of getting a full reauthorization bill done where we can get proper staffing and the proper tools in place to be able to make sure that all of the safety systems are operating at the highest standards.
And flying is the safest form of travel out there. Let us not forget that. You guys know that as well. Like I said, I'll be on a United flight this time next week. I think I'm on a MAX 9, to be honest with you, going across the country. I'm not thinking twice about it. That said, Sarah, do all of your union members and all of your colleagues, do they feel as safe now as they did a couple years ago?
Flight attendants are expressing real concern. And we certainly have heard from the Alaska flight attendants who are very angry that they never should have been put in that position on flight 1282. And the flight attendants who were working that flight certainly feel that way. And so do all of their colleagues who were flying on that aircraft before the incident happened and all of the other planes that had not been properly inspected. So we're talking about a system here that has been shareholder capitalism, that has cut back on staff, has cut back in costs in every single way, and has moved us further and further away from a safety culture. We've got to rebuild that safety culture at Boeing with enough inspectors throughout the federal aviation system and make sure that we are also utilizing all of the reporting systems that are so important to predict possible risk and plug the holes where we can.
Well, literally and figuratively, plug the holes on, you know, at least on one flight. Jeff, number one, do we have a staffing issue? Listen, went through pandemic, a lot of people lost their jobs. Are we back to the staffing levels that we should be at? And if you were sort of, if you became the airline or transportation czar tomorrow, what would be the first thing that you would do?
Boy, that's a tough question. Well, one of the first things is to ensure what Sarah was talking about. We need a fully staffed FAA, fully funded FAA. We also need to change the safety culture, to improve the safety culture, move away from profits and money to safety, because safety is going to drive your profits and money, quite frankly. But I would ensure that the recruiting and retention of airline pilots, airline mechanics, and airline flight attendants be made a top priority, because they're harder and harder to find, and that does put a strain on the safety system.
Jeff and Sarah, listen, an important discussion, a good discussion. Again, flying remains the safest form of transportation, but it's just been a tough week for United and really for Boeing, but we appreciate it. Hope you guys have a good weekend. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Take Jeff's words to heart. Thanks, Jeff.
All right. There you go. Now to the markets and your money. Not a great end of the week. All the major averages dropped. The NASDAQ actually had a pretty sizable drop, just over 1%. By the way, small and mid caps, we've been talking about them for a few months. They finished higher again. Inside the market, your studs and duds since Monday. The big winners, Hewlett-Packard Enterprises, Kroger, Dexcom. The big decliners, lithium producer Albemarle, losing 17%. Tesla down 13%, and maybe that's not driving people to drink because liquor maker Brown-Forman fell 10%. All right, we are live on a Friday, and we are just getting started. Up next, President Biden making some rather shocking comments on the Fed and interest rates. It happened just moments ago at a campaign event. We're going to show it to you. Plus, a rarest of rare events for NVIDIA is the investor fever finally breaking at the world's most important stock. All right, let's get to tomorrow's news tonight. And this is a story you're definitely going to be talking about this weekend, and Wall Street will definitely be talking about on Monday morning. I'm going to tell you right now, I'm going to make a prediction. that on Monday morning, this will be the biggest market story. Just a short time ago, giving a campaign speech in Pennsylvania, President Biden made some eye-opening comments about interest rates and the Fed. Listen.
Guess what? I can't guarantee it, but I bet you. I bet you those rates come down more because I bet you that that little outfit that sets interest rates, it's going to come down.
Wow. Now, the president didn't say the Fed would cut rates, but he did say, as you heard, he'll bet the crowd that it will and kind of leaned in. He's like, I'll bet you. Now, this is notable because presidents rarely make direct comments on interest rates or the Fed, although obviously former President Trump was very critical and remains critical of the Fed and Jay Powell and wanted them to cut rates even before the pandemic. But he's not president. President Biden's comments come as the Federal Reserve have kept rates steady since September of last year. So what should investors and maybe Jay Powell make of these remarks? Let's talk about it with KKM Financial founder and CEO Jeff Kilburg. Jeff, we were going to have you on to talk about NVIDIA. We are still going to talk about NVIDIA. But I, as a former interest rate trader, I got to ask you about this. I mean, it's campaigning, I get it, but these are pretty shocking comments. Like, yeah, I'll bet you, right?
I'm blown away, Sully, to see that come out on a Friday night. And the way he said it, it was such
leaned
confidence.
Leaned in, you know.
Yes, he leaned in. And it was such confidence that it's coming lower. And I was just looking at the CME FedWatch tool. The prediction of rates coming down by 100 basis points, which would be 4 25-point cuts by the end of the year, is still kind of questionable. But after that press conference, maybe he knows something. And I guess the outfit he was referring to is the Fed, of course. But he may have some inside track. You could see the 10-year note, which has moved lower all week from about 430 to 407 to close today. It could tuck back under 4%. And this actually could rocket fuel equities because just about 2 weeks ago, we saw 60 yeah. minutes. We saw all the talk from Fed Chairman Powell that we may not raise interest rates till later. So this is in contrast, but this is wildly shocking to me.
Yeah, and I want some of our audience may just be joining us. Got a lot of people listening on Sirius on the radio. Guys, can we re-rack that? Because I would like to replay this if I could for the audience and for you, Jeff, because to your point, it wasn't like a throwaway comment. He said it twice and then he kind of leaned in. We've got it, Taylor. Great. I want to rerun the Biden.
Let's do it.
Let's rerun it. And then I'll ask you a different question.
Run it back, Sully.
Guess what? I can't guarantee it, but I bet you. I bet you the rates come down more because I bet you that that little outfit that sets interest rates, it's going to come down.
A little outfit with a $7.5 trillion balance sheet. That said, if I was watching like the coach of a football team be like, I'll bet you we're going to cover this weekend. I'm betting the mortgage on that team covering.
Sully, the only thing President Biden didn't do in that little conversation was wink. If he would have winked, that would have been the actual 100% certain he knows something we don't. But that was really wild. I've never seen it. I've been trading treasuries, you know, for 25 years. I've never seen a president who's supposed to be not involved or influencing the Federal Reserve. They are not political. They'll even tell you, Fed Chairman Powell will tell you that. But that type of interaction, that conversation, that's going to blow up over the weekend. That will be the buzz on Wall Street.
Yeah, I mean, well, former president, you know, he was very vocal about the Fed. He's a real estate developer or whatever. And so he likes low rates. But these comments are a big deal. And futures are not open right now. Otherwise, we'd be throwing them up on the screen, Jeff. But
yeah,
I'll bet you that that if they were open, they'd be moving. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you would see buyers of interest rate futures, which, of course, yields react differently. So when they buy the futures, the yields drop. And I think the 10-year note, you will see Sunday night when futures markets open up, it'll tuck back under 4% because we've never had a president say anything like that, insinuate, just short of a wink, Sully. I'm betting that we could see interest rates happen potentially 50 basis points maybe in June. It could even be 25 basis points in March. Maybe he knows something we don't know about. We have a Fed meeting in 11 days.
Well, I'll bet you this will get more attention on Monday morning. But for now, I got to move on because we got to talk about NVIDIA. NVIDIA today, Jeff, and you did a great CNBC Pro article. I urge everybody to sign up for Pro. Go check it out. And you kind of maybe have called this, okay? I want to highlight NVIDIA's day, okay? NVIDIA did not just have its worst day in 9 months, but NVIDIA traded 112 million shares.
Yes.
That represents a value of over $100 billion traded today. And in fact, NVIDIA lost $173.5 billion in market value in 30 minutes. It took them 20 years to make it to $173 billion. It lost that in 30 minutes today. Now, I'm going to ask you as a trader, when we see this kind of volume and that violent of a reversal, I betcha it means something.
It feels like the fever broke, right? NVIDIA has been straight up. Let's rewind slowly just to January of 2023. 14 months ago, this was a market cap company of about $350 billion. It is now $2.2 trillion. So to see the trillions of dollars it's added in its market cap is remarkable. It seems like just 2 months ago when it was trading $550, $600, it could not go any higher. And sure enough, today, it actually went up to $974. So, and this is when I was very active in the options market. We were buying puts, which seems senseless. Why would you buy insurance on a stock that's never going to go down? Luckily, that trade worked out very well today. And we've actually seen about $225 billion come off in market cap from that high point today. And then after hours, NVIDIA actually closed down at $857, another $20 from where it closed in the normal market session. So I think Monday morning could be a rude awakening, because if you look, Sully, technically, there's a gap all the way down to 625 where the 50-day moving average is, where it hasn't been in a long time.
I tell you what, we're going to let you go, but between my friends on Worldwide Exchange, my former show and Squawk Box, they're going to have a busy Monday morning.
I bet you they will. Congrats on 1 year, Sully, to you, Max, and the whole staff at Last Call. You guys are awesome. You're doing a wonderful job.
Today is our one-year anniversary of a show, and appreciate you coming on. Appreciate everybody watching and tuning in. I bet you it'll be a success. Thank you, Jeff.
I bet you it will.
All
see you, Sully.
Still ahead. A stunning twist in Congress's rapid push toward banning TikTok. You don't think it could happen? I bet you it can. It's not deja vu, and it's not just good luck. We got a bonus Tomorrow's News Tonight for you. Just a short time ago, OpenAI announced that CEO Sam Altman will return to the company's board of directors. This news, of course, comes 4.5 months after the board fired him, and then they rehired him, all in a matter of days. Now he's back on the board. What's next? For more, let's bring in CNBC tech reporter Steve Kovac. Steve, thank you for staying late.
Yeah, of course.
But this is what happens when there's news. What's going on?
Yeah, let me explain here. So we have some new board members, including Sam Altman, back on the board, and three other ones in addition to Altman. You have Sue Desmond-Hellman, the former CEO of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Nicole Seligman, the former general counsel at Sony, and VG Simo, the CEO of Instacart. We know her well on this network. And the three current board members, they're staying, of course. Former Salesforce exec Bret Taylor is still the chairman, along with Larry Summers, ever heard of him, mm-hmm. and Adam D'Angelo, the Quora CEO. And not just new board members, a law firm called WilmerHale completed its review into the events around Altman's ouster last fall. It's light on details, but here's what they are saying. The company is going to adopt some new corporate governance guidelines, but unclear right now if that means it's going to nix that wonky nonprofit structure. Also, some information on the events leading up to the firing of Altman. This review said the prior board had the authority to fire Altman and believed it would help with, quote, internal management challenges by doing so. But this review also found the board did not realize the massive disruption that it would cause. There's your understatement of the night. Mm-hmm. Said the firing had nothing to do with AI safety, the company's finances, or statements to investors. Hello, SEC. Basically found out it was a breakdown in the relationship between Altman and the previous board. The vibes were off. That's what they're basically saying here. And finally, WilmerHale found Altman's behavior did not justify his firing. Still, everything's really light in details, though the New York Times did report last night OpenAI CTO Mira Murati. She told the board about her concerns around Altman's management style before the board fired him. Now, the drama appears to be over, but still plenty of questions remain, including that nonprofit structure. If this company is going to IPO one day, things are going to have to change.
Well, she's also in like a fight with Elon Musk, right? I mean, there's this whole
thing. Not to mention the lawsuit with Elon Musk.
I just thought I'd lob that in there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's probably not over. There's the lawsuit with the New York Times. There's a lawsuit with creators like Sarah Silverman over copyright issues. So I'm sure there's going to be more legal cases and things to hit. But for now, the main drama, at least over the board, is over.
All right. Well, that's good news there, but plenty more to come. Steve Kovac, we appreciate it. Thank you. All right. It's not the only technology news out there, folks. Congress fast-tracking a bill that could potentially ban or at least severely limit TikTok. House Republicans are now planning to vote Wednesday on legislation that would give the social media platform 5 months to separate from its China-linked parent company called ByteDance. That's according to reporting from Semaphore. Now, if they fail to do that, it's probably bye-bye TikTok. Lawmakers allege the app poses a national security risk. President Biden today affirming that he would sign the legislation if it passes and makes it to his desk. His 2024 opponent, a guy named Donald Trump, reversing his stance on TikTok. Remember, when Trump was in office, he threatened to ban TikTok, but now he's apparently calling out Facebook as being a bigger threat, instead posting on Truth Social, if you get rid of TikTok, Facebook, and whatever, and Mark Zuckerberg, it'll double their business. I don't want Facebook, who cheated in the last election, doing better. They are a true enemy of the people. We're just reading it, folks. So is Facebook more dangerous than TikTok? Could a TikTok ban actually occur? Let's bring in somebody who knows Facebook very well, cybersecurity expert Alex Stamos. He was the former chief security officer of Facebook and Yahoo, now chief trust officer at SentinelOne, a cybersecurity and AI platform. I want to start with TikTok, Alex, and welcome back, because here's the thing. Congress is afraid of TikTok using its immense reach and platform to potentially influence people in policy. So what does TikTok do? It sends out, we've got a screenshot of it, I think, it sends out a notification to its users to use its immense powerful reach to influence people and policy. I mean, they kind of didn't TikTok just do what the government is afraid it would do.
Yeah, this will go down as the most bizarre and worst decided government affairs decision in the history of the tech industry.
Right? They proved Congress's point. Whoever ran that strategy, I'm sorry, probably should get, you know, severely reprimanded.
Tens of thousands of people called Congress. Congressmen had to turn off their phones. You even had, in at least one case, a teenager threatened to kill themselves if TikTok had been banned, really not demonstrating the kind of responsible behavior that you want to see from a platform that is acting in the best interest of its users.
Yeah, I think to your point, not only did they prove the fears of Congress, hey, we can just send a message out and tell people, you know, to do this, go do this. To your point, Alex, they I'm not going to say they ruined the days of Congress people, but they jammed them up. And theoretically, these are important people and they don't want to deal with 5 million calls from angry TikTokers.
I mean, I think ironically, most of the people picking up the phone are not that much older than the folks who were calling. They're going to be high school and college interns. But yes, I mean, they did probably stall out the people's business and in the House and the Senate. But more importantly, they proved exactly the point that a number of people have made, which is TikTok's incredibly influential. It has not been a very transparent company, you know, much more than other social media companies like a Facebook or a Twitter. TikTok's stream, what you see, is not based upon who you know. It's not based upon your social graph. It's based upon their algorithm.
What made them incredibly popular.
That's right. Yes, they choose. You know, when you go on Twitter, there are algorithmic ranking, but for the most part, it's based upon who you decide to be friends with, to follow. Same thing on Facebook, same thing to a certain extent on YouTube. TikTok just takes content out of their network and puts it in front of you based upon their assumptions of what you're going to like. And that does concern people because it would be quite easy to tweak that algorithm in a way that would be very difficult to detect, that would change what it seemed like most of the people that you want to associate with are saying. And this has most notably been controversial during the Israeli-Hamas conflict because there's a lot of content on TikTok that is quite anti-Israel. Now, there's no proof that TikTok is putting their thumb on the scale. TikTok's user base is very young. Yeah. Young people are more pro-Gaza in this conflict. But the fact that you can't prove it one way or another has been a real problem for TikTok.
Well, we got to let you go, Alex, but there was a time, I think it was not that long ago, when there was like a letter to America from Osama bin Laden that was trending, and people were hearing all these people saying, and I never understood the man, right? Like, that's it. And this is the greatest PR and government affairs disaster at this level in a long time. Alex Stamos, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, now to our quicker than the ticker, all the best of the rest of the headlines.
Let's put 60 seconds on the clock. The SAT going digital. For the first time ever, the college admissions test will be taken with computers and tablets this weekend. Digital test, an hour shorter than the written. It's official. Adam Sandler, the highest paid actor of last year, Forbes estimates that he made a $73 million in large part because of his deal with Netflix. It's International Women's Day. 29-year-old sailor Cole Bauer just became the first American woman to sail nonstop around the world solo. She traveled 30,000 miles over 130 days during the inaugural Global Solo Challenge. Not from this world and not in this world, apparently. According to a new Pentagon report, there is no evidence of alien UFOs. They made their conclusion after reviewing archived and classified files dating back to 1945. That is a gray whale off the coast of Massachusetts. But get this. According to the New England Aquarium, gray whales disappeared from the Atlantic during the 18th century.
Oh, over already. Cool. First gray whale in the Atlantic in a long time. All right, coming up, blasting past Bitcoin is a rocket ride for the Doge coins, the meme coins on the flame, or the cusp of flaming out. Plus, our exclusive list of this week's biggest insider buys and one top executive taking a big swig of his own shares. All right, it's Friday. Thank goodness. So it's time for our exclusive insider buying segment, the top five companies who saw the most stock buys by C-suite executives, he said, by the seashore, and the data coming to us via our friends at Verity Data. So let's go, counting you down 5 to 1. Stock five, trucking company J.B. Hunt Transport, a just over $1 million buy by a board member, his first buy at JBHT. The fourth most insider buying this week, Maryland-based quantum computing company called IonQ, a $1.06 million buy by a board member who is also a board member at Broadcom. Stock three, Jazz Pharmaceuticals, the CFO buying $1.4 million worth of stock. Kind of interesting because this gentleman is a 30-year veteran of Eli Lilly. He just joined Jazz, in fact, bought on his first day on the job. Stock's down 15% in a year. Now to the top two, Gogoat. The battered airline, internet, and connectivity stock down 43% a year must have looked attractive because a board member spending $2.4 million of his own money on that stock, his first buy since May of 2020. But the biggest insider buy of the week, you may be drinking one of their products right now. That is Keurig Dr. Pepper, the CEO spending $4.99 million on the stock. Now, this CEO is stepping down at the end of June, but will remain on the board. By the way, we've been doing this for about 3 years. It's the fourth time that Keurig Dr. Pepper has been on this insider buy list over that time. So there you go. Top five insider buys of the week. J.B. Hunt, IonQ, Jazz Pharma, GoGo, and Keurig Dr. Pepper. Remember, it's a segment you will only see right here on Last Call. All right, speaking of major buys, Bitcoin hitting yet another record today. It broke through 70,000 for the first time ever. It has since fallen below that, but it's the second record this week. And that's not all. There's also Ether on the up and up. Nearly 14% gain over a week. It's sixth straight week of gains, but that's not all. There's more. Goldman Sachs upgrading Coinbase to neutral, but it wasn't a sell. And that actually lifted the stock nearly 6%. But despite all that, it's the meme coins that are really grabbing our attention. Both Shiba Inu and Dogecoin up significantly this week. So how much higher can Bitcoin and these altcoins really go? Joining us now live from the South by Southwest Festival in Austin, Texas, is Mackenzie Sigalos. Austin, obviously home to many Bitcoin developers and miners and owners. Mac, thanks for joining us. I know you just got there. The thing is kicking off, but you have had a chance to talk to some people who are going to be giving keynotes. I got to imagine this is a big story at South by.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, Brian. I touched down in Austin this morning, and I frankly can't think of a better place to be during such a blockbuster moment for Bitcoin. You've got 30% of the world's Bitcoin literally made here, printed out of thin air. You've got the leading coders who come to Texas because of favorable policies. Texas State Capitol is over my right shoulder, and they're clearly doing something right to attract this caliber and volume of talent. But to your point, I've been talking to people on the ground here, and what they're really all coming back to is the record flows of institutional money into the ecosystem thanks to these new spot ETFs. Today's big jump up in price, you saw that happen right around the time that U.S. stocks began trading, which goes to this larger narrative, Brian, that spot Bitcoin ETFs have been a major driver of this rally. Collectively, less than 2 months, these U.S. spot Bitcoin ETFs have brought in more than $56 billion.
Let's get that graphic off the screen because I want to show what's behind. Get me off the screen, okay? I want to show what's behind Mac. Okay, Mac, look over your left shoulder. Look over your right shoulder. There's a new building being built. There's construction everywhere. Bitcoin is at 70. Austin's booming. Are people taking like champagne baths there in Austin because there's just everybody's printing money?
Absolutely. Like the sentiment is so positive. Everything's bigger in Texas, like your Bitcoin price targets, your Bitcoin bulls. And so all the events kick off tonight. South by Southwest has dedicated programming to crypto. Also, AI is another big focus here. But so much of the narrative is really coming back to some of these market moving events, something called the halving, for example. It's really big to the Bitcoin mining ecosystem, which is the epicenter of that is really here in Texas. You've got so many Bitcoin miners. And so they're all talking about that. It's going to be a game changer for the price.
And it is the capital of energy, right? They're there because people don't realize this. Texas is the leading producer of renewable energy in the United States.
Yes, exactly. And so you've got all of this untapped renewable energy, and Bitcoin miners are very mobile. Mm-hmm. So they can go out to remote parts of Texas where you've got a lot of wind and solar power, but it's not connected to a grid, you know, latched onto that and mine Bitcoin. So it's been a really interesting dynamic, both in terms of helping to balance the grid and also create this financial incentive to build out infrastructure to harness renewable energy that was previously untapped.
Unbelievable story. Have a good time at South By. We'll look forward to more Bitcoin tales of Shiba Inu and all that. Not Sheena Easton, Shiba Inu. Mackenzie Sagalos, thank you. All right, on
Thanks,
deck.
Brian.
Called the winner-take-all era for energy, and it could have a big impact on oil, gas, and your money. It's next. All right, if you missed it, and I'm just telling you right now, I bet you, this will be the top story on Wall Street all weekend and on Monday morning. Just over an hour ago at a campaign event in Pennsylvania, President Biden made these comments about the Fed and interest rates.
Guess what? I can't guarantee it, but I bet you those rates come down more because I bet you that little outfit that sets interest rates, it's going to come down.
I know you don't think that's a big deal, folks, but I'm just telling you, when a president of the United States says, I bet you interest rates are coming down, my bet is interest rates are coming down. All right, meantime, the energy sector is a major topic for us here on Last Call. You might have heard about it once or twice. And we have seen a substantial amount of M&A in energy, most in oil and gas, but not all. Now, this could mean that there's now a narrower space to compete. The idea is there a winner-take-all in energy? CBC's Pippa Stevens covers energy, does a great job, works all the time, and appreciate you coming on, Pippa. This is a big lot of deals, really unbelievable.
Yeah, we've seen a record $234 billion worth of deals in the U.S. upstream specifically in the last year, according to Enverus. I know that you've been covering them extensively here on the show. And of course, one of the primary drivers of those is the idea that companies want to secure the best inventory, the best remaining undrilled resources, the prime acreage, because they want visibility into maintaining or maybe even growing their output looking forward. And this consolidation is kind of being seen by some as shale 4.0. So we have this chart from Rystad showing who the key players now in the Permian are. Exxon and Pioneer, if and when that deal goes through, they really take the top spot there, followed by Chevron, Endeavor, and Diamondback, as well as Oxy and Crown Rock, COP and EOG. But beyond just these numbers here, what's really striking is that these six companies hold more than 60% of the remaining inventory in the Permian. And so this has led people like Evercore ISI to talk about this winner-takes-all mentality and the sense that there is an increasingly narrow set of relevant companies. Take a look at this chart. It shows that in the last decade, the average market cap in the energy sector has roughly doubled, while the number of constituents has been cut in half. And of course, Brian, you know, nobody really wants to invest in energy. And so if you are a generalist investor, you're going to target the big players, the Exxons, the Chevron. They're now 43% of overall market cap.
Still minuscule to where they used to be back in the old days when they used a stick to find oil. There's a lot of other stuff weird. I don't want to get into the weeds or the oil patch where, like, you know, Exxon maybe trying to buy Chevron is buying Hess. But there's some talk that Exxon now has the rights to buy that. And if they do, could they cancel the Pioneer deal? This is a crazy time in oil and gas. But is this all just Texas and Guyana, or do we expect this maybe, or other people expect this to kind of spread out a little bit?
Well, there's a sense now that Permian deal making will slow after this.
At some point, you run out of companies to buy.
Well, exactly.
I think is your point.
Exactly. And there's fewer private companies that are, you know, applicable targets. We did see that deal in the Bakken a couple of weeks ago, so maybe we'll see some more there. But I think that these companies are sitting on record amounts of cash after 2022 and those results. And so now that they have that, they've kind of proved that they're no longer going to just drill, baby, drill. And so they have a new investment thesis. And so they're now trying to snap up this inventory. So I think the Permian will slow, but we'll see deal making elsewhere. Also for Nat Gas, we had the Chesapeake Southwestern, but maybe more deals on that side.
Well, we know this. The big winners, energy investment bankers and lawyers.
Yep.
And hopefully shareholders and at least some. Pippa Stevens, appreciate you staying late. Thanks, Pippa. All right. Now, technology's gotten a lot of attention during this rally, but there is one sector that's kind of flown under the radar. Companies that actually make stuff. We call them industrials, but you know, they do all kinds of things. And as a group, they're up 8% this year, the fifth performing, best performing sector in the S&P 500. And it comes as the group has entered what your next guest calls the golden era of construction. Joining us now is Thompson Research Group CEO, Catherine. And by the way, we're going to start by giving you a big shout out, okay? The last time you were on Last Call, it was in, I think, June of last year. It's been too long, but June of last year, you shared one of your top picks. It's a company called CRH. It is a little-known company out of Ireland. And since you made that call on Last Call, all CRH has done is go up 66%. Great call. Hope you and your clients made a lot of money and maybe some of our viewers. Do you still like CRH?
We do. And CRH has been an interesting story because not only is it benefiting from like the golden era of construction, reshoring, population shift, huge investment in government and roads, but it also is benefiting from the shift from exchange from the London Stock Exchange to the NYSE, which happened in September. So you're just seeing more investors in the U.S. that are getting to know CRH. And so there's another company called Holcim. It's traded on in Switzerland. It's taking the same chapter out of the CRH book and is going to spin out its North American ops. And that's due to happen in early 2025. So in general, for CRH, we see a lot more upside for it. It could be 80%+ by our measure.
Wow. A lot of people don't know them. I think they're the biggest maker of just like road paving in the United States. And if you've ever been on the New Jersey Turnpike, we could use a lot more road paving. The other company mentioned, Holcim, I've kind of heard of them, sort of. I'm pretending I have. Swiss, do they trade here?
They're Swiss-based, but they're looking to carve out all of the North American operations. And that operation, which will be about $30 billion in estimated size, will trade on the NYSE. And that's slated to happen in 2025. So there's a little bit more runway, but you're seeing these European companies like CRH and Ferguson that are choosing to move from the European exchanges as their prime exchange to the NYSE. That just means that industrials are hot. America has a lot of money flowing through, and the Europeans are putting money to work, and they're switching their exchanges to the U.S.
Catherine, quickly, any U.S. companies, Vulcan, trying to go through some of the aggregates in my mind?
Yeah. So Vulcan and Martin, but you know, some other names that people may not know about are LPX. They're going to benefit from more of the residential side, but WillScot Mobile Mini, if you go to any major construction site, you're just talking about you're being in Austin, all those construction sites you have WillScot Mobile Mini containers at every single construction site. It's the first thing on, the last thing off, low capex, a lot of cash flow.
Well, great cash flow for hopefully your clients on CRH. Great call, Catherine. Really appreciate you rejoining us. Don't make it so long again. We'll see you again. Thank you very much. All right.
Awesome.
All right. Coming up, the countdown to the Oscars is on, and the stakes for Hollywood may have never been higher. Julia Boorstin is live from the red carpet out in Los Angeles. Julia, big night.
Big night indeed on Sunday, and this year's Oscars come amid concerns about artificial intelligence as well as a declining box office. I'll break down what to expect this weekend coming up after the break.
All right, ahead of Hollywood's biggest weekend, one of the biggest movies of the year is still putting up big numbers. Following an impressive performance at the box office, Oppenheimer is now crushing it on Peacock. According to Nielsen, the film has clocked 821 million streaming minutes in its first week on Peacock. With more on Oppenheimer and all the other films seeking Oscar gold this weekend, is our own Julia Boorstin. She is live where they are literally, I think literally rolling out the red carpet for Sunday night.
Yes, the red carpet's here. It's currently covered by white plastic, but they're getting ready for Sunday night. And the Oscars is the movie industry's biggest marketing event of the year. To watch the nominees online and to promote those viewers, and also to promote a return to theaters. And it comes amid concerns about new AI tools like Sora that could take entertainment industry jobs. And as this year's box office is still down 13% year to date from last year, despite the fact that last weekend's Dune 2 from Warner Brothers Discovery doubled the domestic opening of the first installment of Dune. Now, all of this puts more pressure on returning franchises this year, including Disney's Deadpool and Warner Brothers' Lord of the Rings, to create a phenomenon like last year's Barbenheimer to help move closer to pre-pandemic box office levels. Now, I spoke with Academy Chief Bill Kramer about why the studios and streamers are so eager to win Oscars to validate their content and investments and also to attract talent.
Winning an Oscar is so important in terms of prestige and visibility, and it's the industry rewarding the highest level of excellence in the arts and sciences of movie making. Everybody wants that. It only helps.
Now, Disney Studios have the most nominations with 20. Netflix and Universal both have 18, followed by Apple with 13 and Warner Brothers with 9. Now, the film with the most nominations is Universal's Oppenheimer. 13 nominations is expected to sweep the awards. It's followed by Poor Things with 11 nominations and Apple's Killers of the Flower Moon that has 10 nominations. Now, with the blockbuster performance of Oppenheimer and Barbie, also nominated for Best Picture, Barbie will have two songs performed. Kramer says that he is hopeful that ratings this year will continue their rebound after a low that was hit in 2021. Brian?
Yeah, you got Oppenheimer. I know it's the odds-on favorite. We never know what's going to happen. New York Times said it's a lock. Is it? I mean, you're out there. You live in Hollywood. Could the Holdovers or Killers of the Flower Moon or American Fiction, could they pull off the shock upset, Julia?
So many different movies that were so great this year. I personally really loved Barbie. I also loved American Fiction. I thought Holdovers were great. So a lot of awesome contenders, especially considering that this was a year that was so disrupted by the Hollywood strikes, just in terms of production. But in terms of the favorites, it's really a lot of expectations that Oppenheimer is going to win a range of awards. It hits so many different key points in terms of the importance of the movie, the issues it talked about, the historical nature, and such great performances. So it's expected to win the top prize, but we'll be watching very carefully.
Do you have a personal favorite?
I mean, I love so many of these movies. Barbie was a really fun one for me. It was a big shocker that Greta Gerwig, though the film was nominated for Best Picture, did not get a nomination for Best Director. I think she did deserve that attention. So that's the one that I think missed the Best Director nomination. But I think what is going to be really fun is the songs that are performed at the Oscars. Yeah. There are going to be two songs from Barbie performed, and those are always huge productions, and those are expected to be pretty awesome this year.
Well, we'll watch it. I bet the numbers are good. I bet you the numbers are good. Julia Boorstin, thank you very much. Appreciate it. All right, folks, you know what happened 1 year ago tonight? I think a pretty special show made its premiere on CNBC. It's called Last Call. It's our one-year anniversary show. Yeah, and I didn't wear a tie just in honor of that. Hard to believe it's been 12 months. The regional bank crisis hit right when we started. AI rally, Sam Bankman-Fried, UAW. We've been on the road. We walked the picket lines. We've done all kinds of stuff. And I want to thank everybody from Max to Kyle to Chelsea to Roberto to Kyle, again, to Christina, to Danielle, to everybody. Taylor, thank you, Adrian, for making it happen. See you Monday.